should think about getting a new sign.
Generally, it's considered a faux pas for the bride's family to host a pre-wedding party for her. Fortunately, on the great invisible scroll of Southern wedding etiquette, there's a loophole stating that if most of the guests are in the bride's family, it's acceptable. And werewolf women are very into prenuptial events. Jolene's festivities alone included 2 showers, a pounding, a mate fasting, and something called a bloodening. The pounding is far less violent than it sounds, a party where family and friends give the happy couple a pound of some staple, sugar, flour, and items to set up their household. A bloodening, on the other hand, well, we'll talk about that later. Tonight's agenda included kidnapping the bride to get her sloppy drunk and treating her to a parade of half-naked man flesh, which was some sort of McLean female tradition. But since Jolene's cousins hadn't quite taken the initiative in planning, Jolene had to take matters into her own hands. She suggested we break into her trailer with a provided key to surprise her. It just happened to be on the night Jolene had reserved a table for 8 at the meat market, the only all-male, nearly nude review in the tri-state area. Because nothing says celebration of connubial bliss like men who spend a suspicious amount of time at the gym thrusting their spandex-covered man parts at desperate dollar-waving soccer moms. And because I was the best maid, I got the honor of writing Raylene a check for the genitalia-shaped cake that would be gracing our table. I was also expected to foot the bar tab and serve as designated driver. I ended up driving Mimi's 12-passenger van, which was necessary to haul the half-lit bridesmaids and gift bags containing penis-shaped notepads, refrigerator magnets, coasters, and ice cube trays. When the hell am I going to want penis-shaped ice cubes? Our party was seated in the dark, humid, but surprisingly clean club as Marcus the Matador completed his last twirl about the stage. Jolene was sporting a veil with little foam penises sewn on the hem and a T-shirt covered in lifesavers that offered a suck for a buck, both of which were provided by her cousins, along with the penile party favors. Though the cousins' attention was currently focused on the butt-cheek bacchanalia, Jolene just seemed happy they showed up. She looked so content, sitting there in her obscene veil, oblivious to the improbably dressed fireman shaking it to hot stuff. Her expression was dreamy, extremely out of place considering the setting. It was just like the night she and Zeb announced their engagement, happiness bordering on a coma. The announcement that I responded to by questioning their brain functions for getting married after such a short time. Zeb had to cart me outside before I could further hurt Jolene's feelings, and when he told me she was a werewolf, I freaked out even more and accused Zeb of losing his mind. Dang it. Dick had a point. I was a meddler. "Do you think I'm intrusive?" I shouted over a remix of It's Raining Men. She started and turned her lazy gaze at me. "Hmm? Am I intrusive?" "Yes," she said, nodding, "but in a good way." "How can you possibly be a good kind of intrusive?" She set her drink down, barely noticing when the verdant liquid splashed onto the already sticky table.
"Well, you can be bossy and suspicious and quick to judge. Sometimes your mouth writes a check your butt can't cash."
"We've discussed that you could agree with me less emphatically, yes?" She giggled.
"But you do it 'cause you need to protect the people you love, and that's not such a bad thing."
"I know that I can be sort of..." I paused and then settled for overbearing when it comes to Zeb, his happiness and safety and hygiene, but I would like to say that I'm really glad that he's marrying you. She sniffed and threw her arms around me. There's nothing quite like an armful of drunk werewolf to help you find some perspective.
"I love you, Jane,"
Jolene slurred.
"I love Zeb. I really love Zeb. He's the first man to ever see me as more than a pretty face and hot body."
"It's nice that you're so modest."
"He treats me special, not because of who my parents are, because I'm pretty, but because that's his way," she rambled. "He's gentle and sweet, and he loves me, and I love him."
"I know."
"And you love Zeb."
She giggled, the alcohol in her having clearly convinced her that this was a revelation. "Yep,
But not in a love way, she said suspiciously.
Nope. I have a boyfriend. A boyfriend who engages in mind-blowing sex with me and then doesn't return my calls for 2 days, but a boyfriend all the same.
Good. 'Cause otherwise...
She heaved a drunken sigh and then giggled.
I'd have to kick your ass.
I'm aware. The cousins turned around to see us hugging and collectively rolled their eyes. We straightened up and focused on the show. Speaking of your groom-to-be, where has he been lately? I asked. I haven't seen him in almost a week. Please don't take this as a gripe against him being in a grown-up relationship, but normally he comes by the house every once in a while. Jolene rolled her eyes and sipped her drink.
Mama Ginger's been running him ragged, doing chores around their place. She said she's afraid that after he's married, I'm going to run him ragged, and he's not going to have time to take care of his poor aging parents anymore.
But Zeb has never done chores at his parents' place. They don't do chores at their place. Instead of raking their leaves, they just set fire to their whole yard every fall.
I think he's just doing it to keep her off my back, poor thing, Jolene said. The more he does, the less she complains about him abandoning his family. Of course, she still complains about me, but that's different.
A shadow seemed to pass over Jolene's face. Her lip trembled, and I was afraid the drinks had caught up with her. I reached for her hand, but she straightened and took a deep breath. She stretched a too wide smile over her face and turned her attention back to the stage.
I wonder how much time he spends on waxing, she mused.
I smirked. It's probably a tax deduction. It's a necessary item. I mean, it takes a little hair and a lot of confidence to dance around in that getup. We tapped glasses. Jolene snorted.
Confidence in a couple of gym socks.
After pouring several drunken lady werewolves into bed, I drove the McLean van to River Oaks, taking a shortcut through a sketchier part of town. It was two streets over from where the shop is located. As I passed the Silver Bullet, a bar known for less-than-savory vampire traffic, I saw my Grandma Ruthie's new beau walking out of the place, carrying a case of canned drinks. I managed to stop the van, no small feat for someone unaccustomed to piloting a land yacht, and pulled into a dark corner of the adjacent parking lot. Without enhanced night vision, I wouldn't have been able to make out the labels on the cans, which read, Silver Sun Senior Health Shakes. It was the same kind of can Grandma Ruthie was toting around for Wilbur in her purse. Maybe it's just a coincidence that he's walking out of a vampire bar at 4 a.m. carrying mysterious beverages, I murmured to myself as Wilbur hefted the case into his car. He looked around to make sure that no one was looking and popped the top of one can. He drained it in a few gulps, tossed it into a nearby dumpster, and drove off. Well, at least he doesn't litter, I muttered. Unfortunately, I found that Wilbur hadn't tossed the can into an easy-to-find spot in the dumpster when I inevitably climbed in to retrieve it.
I can't believe I'm doing this, I grunted, sifting through endless beer bottles and newspapers drenched in a substance I dared not consider. This is not normal, rational behavior, sifting through 3 days' worth of extremely pungent bar garbage to find your future step-grandpa's recyclables. There's probably a perfectly reasonable, rational explanation for Wilbur being here. This is probably just some black market health shake with ingredients that aren't improved by the FDA. Oh, dear. Gah!
I squealed as something squirmed beneath my feet. I grabbed the can, leaped out of the dumpster, and did the freaked-out girl dance for a few beats. There was no list of ingredients on the side of the can. I held my prize to my super-sensitive nose and sniffed. I sensed herbs, vitamins, some supplements for joint health, okay, that part was touted on the label, and beneath the slightly chalky bouquet, there was blood. Cold, dead, pig's blood. Okay, maybe there's not a reasonable explanation. I drove myself crazy over the next few days, making complicated but ultimately useless explanations for Wilbur's drinking pig's blood line charts on legal pads. This near Oliver Stone-level conspiracy theorizing kept me absorbed right up until the process server arrived on my doorstep. Jenny's lawyers were demanding that a forensic accountant look through all of my financial records to determine whether I'd sold precious early family heirlooms to pad my personal bank accounts during the course of her lawsuit. Against my better judgment, I had told Mama about the settlement. To assure her that I was financially secure for eternity and would never, ever need to move in with her, so please stop asking. And despite my dire warnings against doing so, Mama had mentioned my windfall to Jenny. And because Jenny does not believe I'm capable of improving my own situation without screwing her over, she concluded that I was up to no good in the Hollow's vast antique black market. Basically, my sister was having me audited. Lovely. Grumpy and frustrated beyond belief, I took advantage of my night off, turned off the phone, and, despite the siren's call of Sense and Sensibility, I read a few more chapters of Mating Rituals and Love Customs of the Wear. I finally found out what a bloodening was. The women of the clan get naked under the new moon and track down a deer, killing it as a pack and bringing it home for a shared meal. It was supposed to be held during the week of the wedding, to assure the bride symbolically that she was still part of the clan and that she would always be welcome to share its food, but also reminding her that she was responsible to continue the clan's traditions. It was a warm, though blood-soaked sentiment. It was a special privilege for an outsider to be invited to witness a bloodening, much less run with the pack, which, as you might have guessed, as best made, I was expected to do. I was going to need some sturdy running shoes and a really good sports bra. I do not run naked. My lolling about on the porch swing in the cold, making no effort to leave the house, seemed to disturb Aunt Jetty.
Is this sudden lean toward shiftlessness linked to all the time you've been spending with Dick?
Aunt Jetty said, in a tone that sounded eerily like Grandma Ruthie. Actually, Dick hasn't wanted to spend much time with me lately, Aunt Jetty. We had an argument, and he's pretty irritated with me.
Is that why he's coming up the drive?
She pointed to the driveway, where a battered El Camino was cutting through the dust. Dick climbed out of the car without making eye contact. He slinked up the porch steps and took a seat beside me. I closed my book and waited. Am I supposed to talk first?
Give me a minute.
He cut me off with a slicing gesture. We sat in silence, with me staring into the distance, wondering what to do with my hands. Finally, he said,
I've been scared to say anything to Gilbert because I didn't want him to be afraid of me or to turn away from me. It's one thing to read about vampires and ghosts. It's another to find out you're related to one.
He studied the creases on his jeans. Unsure of my place in this exchange, I sat and waited.
I knew Eugenia had the baby. My parents paid to keep her away while she was pregnant. When she had him, most of the town whispered about him being mine, but I didn't do anything about it. I knew my parents were sending her money every month, and I figured that was all she needed from me. Don't make that face at me, Jane. I was young and mortal and stupid. I was sent away to handle some contrived piece of family business, and by the time I came back, my parents had sent the baby to an orphanage over in Murphy. They wouldn't hear of bringing him to our home. The scandal, they said. The shame. Even though I know for a fact my daddy had several scandals of his own growing up around town. And then my parents died, and I lost the house to the jackass.
Gabriel, I corrected.
Right, he said. I told myself Albert was better off living at the orphanage in a safe place instead of bouncing around with me, living off card games, sleeping in a fine hotel one night and a ditch the next. That was just an excuse, of course. I didn't know anything about kids. I wouldn't have known what to do with them if I'd had them. I was a terrible father, but a fun uncle. I'd visit Albert, give him penny candy and whatever money I could scrape together. But as soon as it came to real problems, the kid getting sick, getting into trouble at school, I was out of there.
He grimaced.
When I got turned, I realized I shouldn't be around him. It would be too confusing for him, a mysterious uncle who never aged and only visited at night. I was a piss-poor role model anyway. And the people I did business with, they wouldn't have minded roughing up a little boy to make a point. I stopped showing up for visits, and he ran away a couple of months later.
What did you do? I asked.
Part of me was almost relieved, he admitted. I didn't have to worry. I didn't have to bother. And then he came back, full grown, and a spitting image of me, especially in some of his less legal habits. And it was nice. It was nice to be able to watch him, to see him running his business, being a man. I couldn't always agree with some of his decisions, but at that point I was supposed to be about 60 years old and still looked 30-something. I couldn't exactly come back to give him a spanking and fatherly advice. He married, had a son. His son married, had a son. And I watched over them, all of them, watched them live their lives, enjoy their successes, make their mistakes. And most of their mistakes were a lot like mine. It's sort of a Cheney family curse. Good with women, bad with money, I suggested. He shrugged and smiled. I never made contact, he said. I was still hanging around with the same type of people, and the less likely they were to connect me to the family, the better. I couldn't stand it if any of them got hurt because of me. I thought I'd gotten rid of the paper trail when I set fire to the courthouse. Why do you tell me these things? I huffed. You know I have a Girl Scout complex. I never made contact with him, he said, ignoring me. Not until Gilbert. Why Gilbert? He was the first in our family who looked like he might amount to something. He was such a good boy, and in a sincere way. He honestly cared about his mother, his little sister, his classmates at school, his country. He was one of the first boys in the Hollow to sign up for the Army after Pearl Harbor. He was the first man in our family to start college, much less finish it. Dick smiled proudly. And his sister was a sweet girl, just a little, well, stupid. But she was the first girl born to the family in about 5 generations, so she was special, too. When their father died and his mother was having trouble meeting ends meet, I came forward. Just knocked on the door one night. I didn't tell her who I was, exactly. Just a distant cousin who was interested in making sure the family was well taken care of. I think she knew there was something not quite right about me, especially when I told her I didn't want to meet the kids or tell them I was helping them. But she was too happy to accept my money to say anything. I always got the impression that you were lucky to take care of yourself. How did you support a family? I asked. I have ways of making extra money when I need it, he said, slightly offended. When Gilbert needed money for graduate school, I sold a kidney on the black market for tuition. We can grow those back? I asked. It wasn't my kidney. And now we're back to the disturbing territory I'm comfortable with, I snorted. So you're a family man, a loving patriarch. In essence, you're a total fraud. He looked chastened. Don't tell anybody. Are you going to tell him? I think it would mean a lot to Mr. Wainwright to know he has some family left. What am I supposed to do? Come barreling into the store and shout, Hey, pal, want to go outside and play catch with Grandpa? I shrugged. Well, you might want to work your way up to catch. He does have that bad hip. You should at least think about telling him. What have you got to lose? Dick stuck his canines over his bottom lip. All pretense, all of the smug self-assurance fell away as he said, What if he's ashamed of me? You're a vampire. You're the coolest grandpa on the block. He'll be thrilled. I'll think about it, Dick said. Suddenly he raised his voice and poked me in the shoulder. Let me work through this. Don't try to nudge the situation along. Don't drop hints or make conversational segues or... I got it. I told him, raising my hands in self-defense. I wasn't even thinking about it. Dick looked down his nose at me and arched his eyebrow. Okay. I was thinking about it a little bit. Chapter 13. Humans who prove unfaithful to their were-spouses are rarely heard from again. Mating rituals and love customs of the were. My future step-grandpa was an enigma, wrapped in a riddle, stored in a Rubik's Cube, which I always had to resort to rearranging the stickers to solve. I won't pretend my interest was rooted in concern for my grandmother,
just a general weakness in my character that would not allow me to leave a question unanswered. For the record, 4 cans of Starbucks Double Shot Dark Blend Blood and Espresso is just enough to yank a vampire out of bed before sunset. Zeb wisely armed himself with caffeine before entering my daytime lair and enlisted Jetty's help in shoving me into an ice-cold shower in my pajamas to complete the wake-up process. Some older vamps can venture out in the day under controlled circumstances with no problem. I blister and smell like burnt popcorn, which stays with you for days. So I slathered myself in Solar Shield SPF 500 sunscreen and donned huge Jackie O sunglasses and a wide-brimmed hat before venturing out to my newly sun-safe car. Okay, fine. Zeb had the motor running, and I dove through the open door, unbelievably exhilarated by my not bursting into flames. As he turned the key in the ignition, Zeb asked, "Remind me again why we're risking you bursting into flame to drive 70 miles to some old folks' home?" Clearly, he didn't appreciate the mama-caliber guilt tactics I'd used to get him to accompany me on this little excursion. Because when I snuck a look into Wilbur's wallet, this was the address on his ID. Zeb was aghast.
"You snuck a look at his wallet? When?"
"Christmas," I said, looking down to avoid his glare.
"Why would you do that?"
he demanded. "He left it right there in his coat pocket. Come on."
"You are not allowed to hang out with Dick anymore,"
he told me as he turned the ignition.
"So why couldn't we do this after dark?"
I called the front desk, pretending to be a potential resident's daughter. The nurse said dinner was served at 3:30, and I'm guessing the people we'd want to talk to will be asleep by 4.
"You're a scary woman, Jane Jameson."
I shrugged, pulling my hood over my face and leaning my seat back to a snoozing position. I do what I can. I jolted awake when Zeb cut Big Bertha's engine outside the Sunnyside Village retirement community. With one eye squinched shut, I wiped the drool off my cheek and looked around. The building seemed innocuous enough. Overtly cheerful yellow siding on a cracker box building, glowing in the orange light of the fading sun. Newly painted white shutters, framing windows with the shades drawn tight. I pulled out my sunblock for safety touch-up. I decided against gloves, as it was a typically mild early spring day, and full-length opera gloves would probably attract attention. The thick, white SPF 500 lotion took a while to absorb into my neck, chin, and hands. I pulled the hat over my eyes. "How do I look?" I asked, turning to him.
"Well, if we were going to a performance of Kabuki Mugger Theater, this look would be perfect," he snorted, gesturing to my smudged jawline. "You might want to blend some more."
"Dang it," I grumbled, swiping at my cheeks. After a few more minutes of sunblocking, I carefully opened the door and stepped out. I gasped, enveloped in the sun for the first time since my turning. Even though it was weak late afternoon light, I was overwhelmed by the warmth that swirled over my skin like a caress. The colors made me want to weep. I hadn't realized how monotonous the night sky could be. I'd missed the burnt golds, the blushing pinks giving way to deep purple as the sun faded over the horizon. I smiled, stretching out my hands and basking in heat like a cat. And then, ow, 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 ow. I'd forgotten to sunscreen the delicate webs between my fingers. Ow! It felt as if I dipped my hands in acid. I stared in horror, transfixed as the skin sizzled and smoked.
"Put your hands in your pockets, Jane,"
Zeb cried. "Oh, right." I stuck my shaking hands into my jacket and turned my back to the light, doubling over, waiting for the pain to subside. After a few moments, I felt the tissue in my fingers knit itself together again, a new and unpleasant stinging sensation unto itself. I took a deep breath and straightened, flexing my fingers gingerly. Zeb was staring at me over Big Bertha's hood.
"I don't think you want to go in there with smoking hands that smell of blackened Jiffy Pop," he said.
"I think I'll just stay in the car," I said meekly.
"Probably for the best,"
Zeb said, nodding and pressing his lips together in a resigned line. I stayed huddled behind the heavily screened windows, napping, while Zeb ventured inside. I was tired, drained, all of my being focused on my raw, healing skin. When your mortality is taken out of the equation of life, you tend to take certain things, such as paralyzing agony, for granted. Is that what it would feel like to go out during the day? I imagined it was only a fraction of the pain an unprotected vampire would suffer in full sun. And even that small portion was torture. Of the few ways vampires could die, death by suntan was definitely at the bottom of the list. A short time later, my partner in crime startled me awake with a sharp knock on the window.
I just barely convinced him that I was the great-grandson of the oldest guy there, whose name I did not know. I had to keep calling him Pappy.
What did he say? I asked, rubbing my tired eyes. Had he heard of Wilbur Goosen?
No. He was far more interested in a rerun of Matlock than talking to me. And then some other guy heard me say Wilbur's name, and he made the weirdest, wrinkliest face I'd ever seen. Then he cursed at me in Lithuanian and whacked me with his cane, Zeb said, rubbing his arm gingerly. He then switched to English and suggested I perform various sexual acts on myself.
If you could do that by yourself, we would never see you, I said, despite the glare Zeb sent my way. How did you know it was Lithuanian? He seemed offended.
Like you're the only smart one around here.
Sorry I put you through all that for nothing.
No. On the way out, while I was dodging the cane, a much nicer lady stopped me. She apparently had her hearing aids turned all the way up and heard our conversation. She was an old flame of Wilbur's.
Say what now?
When Wilbur Goosen lived at Sunnyside, he was quite the Don Juan. Isla Fay Pogue, the lady in question, was one heart torn asunder in the swath he cut across the shuffleboard circuit. At one point there was a catfight in the rec room among three of his interests, wigs and walkers and glass eyes flying everywhere.
I don't need to think about that.
Mrs. Pogue had photos in her album. The administration was on the verge of asking Wilbur to leave when he just passed away in his sleep. It was all very sudden.
He died? Are we sure she had the right Wilbur Goosen?
How many Wilbur Goosens could there be? He pointed out. I nodded. Besides, she had pictures of the two of them. Kissing.
He showed me a sample photo. I winced. Blech, don't I have enough Randy geriatrics in my life? And she was sure he died?
Well, they buried him, he said, starting the car. So, what would that make him? A vampire? A zombie?
This isn't really my area of expertise, I said, but it explains the health shakes.
Well, have you ever seen him during the day?
I don't see anybody during the day.
Aren't there some vampire tests we can do? We can make him touch silver. Put him under a sun lamp. Oh, we can force feed him garlic bread.
I like your enthusiasm. But why don't we just ask him? I suggested.
Well, where's the fun in that? Zeb pouted. Besides, what are you going to say? Hi. I know you want to marry my grandma, who I'm not on great terms with, but I was hoping you could tell me whether you're, you know, an undead gigolo hell-bent on killing her and taking the family fortune. I'm sure that would improve your relationship with Ruthie. Come on, let's sprinkle silver shavings in his pants. Well, what are you going to do?
He said when I ignored his proposal.
Find his lair? Do your best Peter Cushing imitation?
I shot him the arched eyebrow of bewilderment. He responded by wrapping his fingers around a pretend stake and made stabbing motions. At least I hoped it was a pretend stake and stabbing motions, because otherwise our relationship just took an upsetting and inappropriate turn. Why would I do that? I asked.
Because he's evil.
I gaped at him. Because he's probably not 100% human, we should assume he's an evil monster? Zeb's face sagged into oops lines. Yeah, how's that foot taste?
Sorry, he said. Sometimes I forget that you're not 100% human.
Humph. On the drive back to town, I tried to work up the nerve to bring up Zeb's odd behavior, the unexplained absences and chores at his mama's house. Was Zeb thinking about leaving Jolene at the altar? Was that even possible when you were mated to a werewolf? Zeb avoided the fully exposed highways in favor of more shaded back roads, where we were treated to fantastic scenery. Weeds almost high enough to hide the junked cars and defunct riding mowers, trailers with rotting underpinning flapping in the wind. And there was a school bus parked next to almost every house, most of which did not appear able to run. I kept telling myself I would just blurt out the first question at the next trailer we saw, and the next, and the next. But I couldn't bring myself to do it. I wasn't sure if I wanted to know if Zeb was capable of jilting Jolene. I didn't want to know if he was capable of hurting someone that way, of that level of deceit. These aren't thoughts you want to have about your best friend. We were halfway back to the hollow when I started feeling a little dizzy. I ignored it until the sensation turned into full-on vertigo. My throat was so dry. I looked at the clock. Crap. "What's wrong?" Zeb asked.
"You look pale-er."
I covered my mouth with my hand and shook my head as a hot iron fist closed around my belly.
"Remember when we were 9 and we rode the Tiltinator until you threw up cotton candy in my lap?"
he asked.
"You looked better then."
I braced myself against the dashboard, palms against the worn, warm faux leather. "It's just that I'm getting a little, hungry."
"I thought you had a special little fridge in here for blood. Didn't you bring anything with you?"
"I didn't think a bag lunch would be required," I said. "I ate right before we left, but being out during the day, I didn't realize it would be so draining."
"What about a store? Can we stop somewhere?"
I doubled over as another cramp clenched my belly. I wheezed.
"The closest store is Bubba's Beer and Bait, and that's about 10 miles away. I don't think he carries bottled blood. In fact, Bubba has a little sign on his door that says, 'No shoes, no pulse, no service.'"
Zeb mulled that over.
"They used to use the milk of young coconuts for a plasma substitute because of its high iron content. I saw it on the Discovery Channel."
"Well, that would be really handy to know if we're ever stranded on a desert island." I smacked him. "If I can't get blood, how the hell am I going to get a young coconut?"
"I know, I'm sorry, I'm panicking," he cried.
"Just keep driving," I panted.
"Talk to me, keep me thinking about something else." "What do you want me to talk about?"
"Anything. Your kindergartners, wedding stuff, anything," I exclaimed, wincing at the empty churning in my stomach. "You've been talking my ear off for years, Zeb. Don't tell me you've run out of things to say."
After a long, silent moment, Zeb's voice came deep and clear.
"You could feed from me."
"Don't you think that would be weird?" I said, thinking about the first feeding with Andrea. I hadn't fed from a human since that cringe-inducing attempt, and it was a good while before I was completely comfortable around her again.
"I love you, Jane," he said, parking the car on the shoulder. "I want to help. This is our last big, stupid adventure. Let's go out with a bang."
"I don't think it would be..."
"Jane."
I sighed. "I'm not biting your neck. Too intimate." I made an icked-out face at him, prompting him to offer his wrist.
"Are you sure?" "Do it before I change my mind,"
he snapped, then yowled when my fangs pierced his skin. He tensed, then forced himself to relax, leaning back in the seat, avoiding contact beyond my mouth on his wrist. I focused on the mechanics of feeding, fangs into skin, sealing the lips around the wound to gently pull the blood to the surface. I thought fondly of Funyuns and Cokes sipped through uncapped Twizzlers, the sort of cuisine we enjoyed on afternoon trips to Hickman Lake after Zeb got his driver's license. When he stroked a hand across my back, I shrugged it away. More insistent, his hand curled around my jaw, caressing my cheek as I fed. I did not want to think about the pseudo-Freudian aspects of penetration and oral fixation. This was lunch. This was takeout. At least that's what I told myself until Zeb moaned a little, throwing his head back against the seat. This sly, creepy voice in my head whispered, "You could take it all. Snuff out his life like a sputtering candle. Turn him. Keep him with you. A few more sips. He's enjoying it."
"Stop,"
I said, pulling away. A sleepy, almost sensual expression had settled on Zeb's features, and he leaned back in the seat and stretched. He grinned conspiratorially at me as he rubbed his wrist.
"You okay?"
he asked, his eyes glazed over and hazy again. He seemed barely able to focus on me. "Fine," I promised, shaking away the guilt-inducing voice in my head. "Does it hurt?"
"No,"
he said, massaging his wrist, where a dark purple mark was forming. The wound was already closing up, but he would have the bruise for a while. "Here." I dragged my fingertip across a fang and made a tiny cut. I squeezed it over Zeb's wrist, letting a few drops of blood fall into the closing wound. The skin immediately healed, and the bruising vanished.
"Thanks."
Zeb smiled fondly at me, stroking the tendrils of hair back away from my face. His voice sounded so far away, as if he was repeating lines he'd heard in a movie. But it was the eyes that were unnerving. They were so vacant. There seemed to be no trace of Zeb in them. His lips parted, and his breath quickened as he leaned toward me. A zing of panic slipped up my spine as his mouth drew closer to my own. I struck out, popping Zeb on the nose with my half-closed fist. It was sort of a cross between a punch and a slap, right in the middle of his face. "What are you doing?"
"Ow!"
he cried, now fully undazed and clutching his bleeding nostrils.
"What did you do that for?"
"You do not kiss me! You got it?" I shouted.
"What do you mean I don't kiss you?"
he cried, tilting his head back against my seat as I shoved a tissue at him. "I mean, you don't kiss me."
"I wasn't going to kiss you,"
he insisted. "Zeb, it's been a while, but I'm pretty sure I recognize the 95% lean-in when I see it."
"The last thing I remember is your fangs breaking my skin,"
he said, dabbing at his nose and checking it in the rearview mirror. "You honestly don't remember leaning toward me with your mouth half open?"
"No."
I stared at Zeb for a long time, debating whether I should look inside his mind and determine whether he was lying. Ultimately, I chickened out. Looking into his head at the moment seemed so intrusive and scary. Honestly, I wasn't sure if I wanted to know what the hell he was thinking, or if he was thinking. What if the reason he seemed so unsatisfied with Jolene lately was that he was having feelings for me? How could he do that to either of us? How could he change the rules of our friendship that way without even telling me? How was I going to tell him that the two of us would never, ever be more than what we were? What if I lost my best friend? "Just take me home," I said finally, slumping against the seat. We spent the rest of the drive in silence, with me staring out the window, trying to ignore the nervous bundle of BFF at the wheel. As soon as he pulled Big Bertha into my driveway, I threw a solar blanket over my head, yelped, "Good night," and dashed for the door.
"Jane, we need to talk,"
Zeb called after me.
"Good night,"
I yelled as I struggled to fit the key into the front door and keep the protective blanket in place. I slammed the door behind me and threw the deadbolt in place, just in time to hear Zeb say,
"All right, then."
I closed my eyes, praying he wouldn't come to the door and try to talk about what just happened. I leaned my head back against the glass, listening for the sound of Zeb's car starting up and driving away. I caught sight of my reflection in the pier glass in the foyer, the oddly beautiful pale woman in the mirror, her face flooded with relief at the sound of a Datsun's engine revving. I glared at the image. "You are a coward." My reflection was decidedly unhelpful. Chapter 14. Any male who marries more than two mates is ostracized from the pack. Most females would consider him a jinx at that point anyway. Mating rituals and love customs of the wear. In order to avoid thinking about Zeb and inappropriate touching, I threw myself into ferreting out more information on my future step-grandpa. I figured, of the two problems, Wilbur's past was far less likely to come back and bite me on the butt. Gabriel found me, up to my elbows in cyberspace, searching through a not-quite-legal connection to the state's vital statistics database. The library was granted access for archive purposes, and Mrs. Stubblefield hadn't bothered to change our password since I was fired. Honestly, what was she thinking? I had access to birth certificates, marriage licenses, and death certificates, the only problem being that they were in abstract form, giving the barest essentials of names and dates. After I gave only a cursory grunt for a greeting, Gabriel cautiously climbed onto the couch next to me and watched as my fingers flew over the keyboard.
"I'm fine, thank you, dear. How are you?"
he said pointedly. I made a kissing noise in his general direction but continued my search.
"I didn't mean to interrupt,"
he grumped. When I finally looked at Gabriel, I saw that he was wearing a well-cut black suit with a blue silk tie. I'd never seen him in his business attire before. He would have been mouth-watering if not for the anxious lines between his brows, the nervous glint in his eyes.
"What are you doing?"
"Stalking my future grampy via an obscenely fast wireless connection," I said, tapping away at the keys. He blinked at the wildly scrolling screen.
"Is that slang or a Jainism?"
"A little of both," I said. While the search engine compiled marriage records for Goosens between 1960 and 2007, I kissed his chin and rubbed my eyes. "I'm looking up old Mr. Goosen in the state archives. So far, all I found is his birth certificate, which is normal, and his death certificate, which is, considering that he's walking around, not normal." He stroked a hand across my shoulders.
"You know, I've never seen this aggressively intellectual side of you before. It's rather disturbing, and yet somehow a little sexy."
"Which is pretty much how we define our relationship," I said, turning back to the screen. I heard his delicate intake of breath beside me.
"Was Zeb just here? His scent seems particularly strong in this room."
"Please stop sniffing me for evidence of other people," I groaned, cutting off my contrived, indignant response. Instead, I quietly said, "I had to feed from him."
"Why are you making that face?"
he asked, tucking his thumb under my chin.
"There's no reason you shouldn't feed from Zeb."
"I sort of vowed not to feed from humans, remember?" I said. "I was doing great, 6 months clean and passive. And then Zeb tried to kiss me, and it all just went to hell from there."
"I'm sorry."
Gabriel shook his head, laughing.
"For a minute, I thought you just said that Zeb tried to kiss you."
I gave him a look that was part wince, but mostly cringe.
"Oh.
I know," I groaned. "I don't know what's going on. It's like the whole world's just gone cockeyed. And while I was feeding, I had all these weird thoughts, and they were dark and hungry and sly, and they kept telling me to drink more, take more, turn him, keep him with me. Does that mean this is my fault? Did I accidentally put some of my subconscious thoughts in his head because I'm afraid of what's going to happen to our relationship when he and Jolene get married? Is that why he tried to kiss me? Did I do this with my evil vampire temptress powers?" Gabriel leveled me with his serious paternal gaze.
"Jane, do you want to have sex with Zeb?"
My eyes widened to the size of dinner plates. "Lord, no!"
"So this couldn't be your fault. The voice in your head? That's just a blood thought."
Gabriel laughed and cupped my face between his palms.
"It's the vampire brain's response to live, fresh blood, a physiological attempt to keep the vampire as well-fed as possible for as long as possible. We never know when our next meal will be, so the receptors in your brain that interpret pleasure all start firing at once. You get overloaded with endorphins, and you start having thoughts. Well, thoughts I'd rather you didn't describe to me. But it's perfectly natural, particularly for those who rarely feed on live blood. Your brain was just overcompensating for time lost."
"So I don't really have dark, hungry feelings for Zeb?"
"In a universe that is decent and good, no."
He shook his head.
"Thank you,"
I breathed, leaning against him. I thought I was having some sort of bizarre psychic reaction to the wedding, or maybe an aneurysm. I was hoping for an aneurysm. Gabriel's voice tightened.
That does, however, mean that I must have a talk with Zeb about appropriate behavior for engaged men, particularly engaged men who expect to continue to spend time with you and retain the use of their limbs.
I snorted. And if that doesn't work, what's next? A paid chaperone?
If necessary. I'm sure Dick could use some extra cash,
Gabriel muttered, tensing when I shot him a warning look.
I'm very fond of Zeb. He's a fine young man, and I enjoy spending time with him. But if he thinks he can make advances toward you because of a misguided case of cold feet, he is sorely mistaken.
I'm pretty sure I got that point across when I made his nose bleed, I told him.
You hit him?
He asked, grinning.
That's my girl.
I don't think he even realized he was doing it. He had this odd, glazed-over look in his eyes, and he just leaned in. We were both pretty mortified once we got his nose mopped up. Is it possible his brain is just overreacting to being bitten? I mean, Andrea's reaction when I fed from her was sort of happy, but she didn't try to make out with me.
It's possible, he conceded.
When he saw the relief flood my face, he groaned.
This is one of those issues you're going to insist on handling yourself, isn't it?
I nodded.
If he does it again...
If he does it again, you have my permission to break his legs and arms and make him believe he's a rodeo clown from Walla Walla, I promised. We can make him call himself Slappy the Wonder Clown.
Fine. On to less disturbing subjects. Can I see what you've found so far?
I turned my laptop to show Gabriel the sad little no records found screen. I can't find him registered in the state's database of the undead. According to this, he died almost 15 years ago, so why wouldn't he register? He's an old vampire, hardly threatening. What's he afraid of?
Maybe he's not a vampire,
Gabriel said. But what else could he be?
I honestly don't know,
he admitted. Well, you're no help, I grumbled. I've tried reading his thoughts, but he must be one of those people I can't get through to because I got nothing.
You can't just go around thumbing through people's brains when it suits you, Jane.
Oh, you've wiped my parents' memories like Windex, and now suddenly there's a boundary? Gabriel gently pried the laptop out of my hands and put it on the coffee table.
I can only guess that Wilbur is a lonely being, either natural or supernatural, and he genuinely enjoys your grandmother's company.
No, that can't be it, I muttered, grabbing the laptop and clicking into another search engine. I typed in Wilbur's name. Does this seem like a lot of results in the wedding license section? I scanned the folder. The name Wilbur, Will, Bernie, or Gus Goosen showed up 6 times over the last 15 years. Each wife died within a year of their marriage.
Can you tell what they died of?
He asked, intrigued. I'm going to do something slightly illegal, so you might want to turn your head, I told him. Gabriel, unfazed, merely smirked. I gave an exaggerated sigh.
You have been warned.
I clicked on an online database that was supposed to be limited to licensed medical examiners. It said so right at the top of the screen in big red letters. I entered a valid username and password, prompting Gabriel's jaw to drop. I explained, Jolene has a cousin working in the county coroner's office. He can be bought with summer sausage. Gabriel sighed.
Well, of course she does.
Okay, first up, first wife, Dulcie, had a stroke in 1991, age 70, nothing suspicious, I said, poring over the digitized paperwork. Here's a death certificate for Wilbur, dated 1993, cause of death listed as natural.
Natural what? Gabriel asked.
I clicked and scanned. Just natural. There was no autopsy. The coroner wrote that the death was unremarkable and likely connected to the deceased's chronic heart condition. Gabriel scrunched his nose.
So the cause of death was he was old?
According to this, his body was released to Aronson's funeral home a day later, next of kin listed as Jerry Goosen, Wilbur's son, a resident of Ashton, Oklahoma. I can only hope that Jerry chose the cheapest funeral home in the state because he picked the first one he saw in the Yellow Pages. Is it normal for vampires to get a death certificate? Gabriel, fully invested in my little Nancy Drew investigation now, nodded.
It can happen if a just-turned fledgling is found by humans before he or she can rise.
Since autopsies and embalming involve removing organs and most of the blood from the body, vampires don't tend to fare well. They turn out wrong somehow, weaker, diluted. When was his next marriage certificate dated?
I chewed my lip, switching back to the vital statistics database. In 1994, a Bernie Goosen married Ms. Ethel Brown. She died a year later as the result of anaphylactic shock from multiple bee stings. She'd been gardening. Coroner ruled it accidental. Then, in 1996, a Will Goosen to Mrs. Dee Dee Wilkins Reed. Her death certificate is dated 6 months later. Cause of death, blunt trauma to the head. A leg of the shower stool she was sitting on collapsed, and she was thrown to the floor, hitting her head on the tile. Coroner ruled it accidental. In 1998, Gus Goosen married Mrs. Judy Wooten. She choked on a piece of peanut brittle. Coroner ruled it, all together now, accidental. I sifted through the online files. I'll grant you that the first one was natural, and maybe even the second one was an accident, but after that, I think Wilbur figured out how much fun marriage for profit could be. What are the odds that Wilbur isn't bumping his wives off Bluebeard style?
It could just be a coincidence, you know.
I stared at him. He jerked his shoulders.
It's not likely, but it could be a coincidence.
I think my grandma may have finally met her match, I marveled.
You are very good at this, he said, adding, stay away from my tax records.
Too late, I told him absently. He jumped, but that was probably because I suddenly started waving my hands.
Wait, wait, wait! Is that an I'm thinking gesture or I have a headache gesture?
He asked. Thinking. Weakened old vampire. Diluted. I read something like this. I ran upstairs and snatched my copy of Spectrum of Vampirism off my nightstand. As I sprinted down the steps, I called out, normally it doesn't take me this long to finish a book. This thing reads like stereo assembly instructions. In Korean. But listen to this. Of the many shades of vampirism, the most weakened and diluted state is that of so-called ghouls, vampires who have been embalmed. Because some vampire fledglings are believed to have been murdered or attacked by animals, they are embalmed and treated for burial. Despite the blood being drained, the vampire will survive the process if the heart and brain are left intact, which sometimes happens with lazy or inept embalmers. Reports of this phenomenon can be found as early as ancient Egypt. The nightmare of cursed mummies rising from their sarcophagi was born of priests skipping steps in the mummification process on newborn vampires. Embalmed vampires rise on the third day, deprived of the vampiric blood that turned them. They are able to withstand serious injuries, though they heal more slowly than full-fledged vampires. They also lack the strength and agility of vampires. They can also withstand weak sunlight and require only small amounts of blood to survive. I looked at him expectantly. He shrugged.
He's a ghoul! I knew it! I yelled.
Gabriel laughed.
No, you didn't.
I grunted in frustration.
I know.
What should I worry about first? Him hurting her as a human or biting her and trying to turn her? Because I do not want to think about an eternity with Grandma Ruthie in it.
Actually, ghouls aren't that dangerous, Gabriel said. They're only interested in dead blood. It's the only thing they can digest. So they don't go around biting people, and they can't turn a human into a vampire. They can only create other ghouls. The question is, what do you do with this information?
I don't know. I mean, I could warn her, I said. Or I could just let it play out for my own personal amusement. Gabriel tisked and lifted my chin.
The Jane I know and love wouldn't let her grandmother suffer for her own personal amusement.
Oh, baby doll. I snickered and kissed the tip of his nose. I don't think you know me as well as you think you do. So, what are we up to this evening? You want to go see another movie? Or we could just hang out here? Gabriel's face tensed. All of the breezy charm of the last few minutes melted away.
Actually, I can't stay. I should have mentioned I was just dropping by on my way to the airport. There's a quarterly staff meeting at my hotel that I can't afford to miss again. I like to put in an appearance every couple of months. It tends to keep the humans honest. I'm flying out to Atlanta tonight. It's just for a few days. I'm sorry I forgot to mention it.
I could come with you,
I offered. I love Atlanta. Well, I've never been there, but I'm a big fan. You know, Gone with the Wind, the Braves, the Turner Broadcasting System. I was really grasping with that last one. It wouldn't be any fun for you, Jane. I'll be in meetings all night. I'd hate for you to wander around alone. Who knows what sort of trouble you could get into. He meant for it to be a joke, but there was a brittle, too bright quality to his voice. I really don't mind, I said, acting oblivious to his hasty refusal. I'd like to see the hotel. I feel I only know the hollow version of Gabriel. I'd like to see what you're doing when you're out in the world. Gabriel seemed to grasp the double meaning. We stared at each other for a long time. I was practically daring him to make another lame excuse, another lie. I was done letting him off the hook. He could keep making up stupid stories if he wanted to, but I wasn't going to make it easy for him. Gabriel's mouth set in a thin, cool smile. "Not this time, Jane," he said, standing abruptly and kissing me on the temple. "I'll see you when I get home." He was halfway to the door when I finally worked up the nerve to say, "You know, eventually you're going to run out of excuses. You're going to have to tell me the truth." His smile was quick, effortless, but it didn't reach his eyes. "Is that another Jainism? Your version of have a nice trip?" I glared at him, refusing to be charmed. "I'll see you soon," he said quietly, and walked out. The click of the door closing behind him seemed to echo in my ears, a harsh metallic scraping that bounced off the sudden emptiness of the house. Alone again, I continued to tap at the computer keys, afraid of what I might do without something to occupy my shaking hands. Chapter 15. Offspring are considered the purpose of marriage, so newlywed wares should expect heavy pressure for babies early on. Many couples receive layette sets as wedding gifts. Mating rituals and love customs of the wear. When I heard the baby crying on my front porch, I thought I was having a nightmare. Still in bed, I stuck a finger in my ear and wiggled it, hoping to pop loose whatever might be causing that god-awful noise. But it persisted. I sat up. There was weak sunlight peeking around the edges of my blackout curtains. Judging by the why reaction radiating from my internal clock, I guessed it was around 5 p.m. I'd managed to race into bed before dawn the morning before. About an hour after Gabriel left my house, I Googled directions to his hotel and decided that I was going to drive down there to see what he was up to myself. I'd crossed into Tennessee by the time I realized that I was behaving like a crazy person. I pulled Big Bertha off onto the shoulder just outside Union City and leaned my head against the steering wheel. What was I doing? What was my plan? Was I going to follow Gabriel around with a pair of binoculars and spy on him? Break into his hotel room and tell him I just couldn't resist surprising him? Gabriel had told me he didn't want me there. At best, I would find nothing was amiss and look like an annoying, clingy psycho who couldn't respect boundaries. At worst, I would go to Atlanta and find him shacked up with some other woman, or find that he wasn't in Atlanta at all. And what could I do then? I would have a meltdown in the middle of a strange city with no connections, no friends, nothing. I would probably wander the streets in a daze until the sun came up and I was a little pile of Jane ashes on the sidewalk. This was definitely a Marianne move, and not in the good way. I drove back to the hollow and pulled into the driveway just as the sun was rising over the roof of River Oaks. I dashed into the house and pulled the covers over my head, falling into a fitful sleep. Nightmares about crying babies fit right into that. The baby's squalling was soon joined by pounding on my front door. I stumbled down the stairs, calling for Aunt Jetty in a voice that couldn't be heard by my visitor. No response. My dead aunt picked a fine time to become a social butterfly. Careful to stay in the cool, dark recess of the foyer, I opened the door to find Mama Ginger standing on my front porch, holding a squirming bundle of pink blankets. This had better be a hallucination, I stammered.
Jane, Mama Ginger squealed, I'm so glad you're home. This is Nevea. We call her Nevy for short.
Nevaeh? I repeated as she bustled into the house, trailing blankies and diaper bags.
It's heaven spelled backwards. Isn't that clever?
Mama Ginger trilled, putting the baby into some sort of collapsible, bouncy thing she pulled out of her bag. Way to sentence a kid to a lifetime spent popping out of cakes, I muttered. I felt an immediate flash of guilt when the baby opened her heavily lashed blue eyes and focused on my face. I patted her tuft of dark hair gently. I didn't mean that. Okay, I totally meant that. Mama Ginger popped a pacifier into the baby's mouth, which temporarily stopped the ear-splitting wails.
I was supposed to babysit little Nevaeh tonight, but poor Floyd is having an emergency down at the Goose Lodge and needs my help.
Floyd frequently had emergencies down at the Goose Lodge, most of them involving injuries sustained while fist-fighting the pinball machine.
So I figured you wouldn't mind watching her while I just popped over to the emergency room,
she said, hoisting her purse onto her shoulder. Wait, what? No, I cried. Mama Ginger was startled as I cut her off at the door, trying to comprehend how I'd managed to beat her there. I don't know how to take care of a baby.
Oh, don't be silly. She's only 4 months old. What's to know? Besides, you used to babysit all the time.
Yes, small children and preteens, I insisted, as Nevaeh bubbled a yellowish goo from her nose. People who were potty trained and didn't ooze weird substances.
You'll be fine,
Mama Ginger insisted, and dashed out the door into the setting sunlight where I could not follow.
Gah! Persuasion voice! Why can't I ever remember to do that damn persuasion voice?
I cried, prompting a mewling cry from Nevaeh. Okay now, I said, scooping the baby awkwardly out of the bouncy and balancing her on my arm. Let's be reasonable. I don't know you, and you don't know me. We don't have to start the evening off by annoying each other. The baby, who didn't know the meaning of the word reasonable, wailed even louder. Mind if I cry too? I asked as the weight of the situation settled on my shoulder. I didn't even know who her parents were. Of course, I wasn't sure I wanted to know someone who would name their daughter Nevaeh. But for all I knew, Mama Ginger was trying to set me up on a kidnapping charge. My house wasn't baby-proofed. I didn't have any emergency contact numbers or a first aid kit. I could only pray there was formula and diapers in that bag, because otherwise this kid might have to make do with Diet Coke and paper towels. I rocked the baby gently, making a swishing noise until she quieted. She stared at me under heavy, half-closed lids, her little rosebud mouth slack. Of course, this was just a precursor to her projectile vomiting on me. I shrieked, swiping at the milky ick dripping from my chin. This startled Nevaeh, who commenced with more crying. I joined in with her again as I tried to remove the chin goo with the wipes I found in her diaper bag. "What is it?" I asked desperately. "Are you sleepy? Grumpy? Just name a dwarf and I'll do what I can. Are you hungry? I can fix hungry." I carried the baby and the bag into the kitchen, where I fished out a bottle with a small amount of white powder. I sincerely hoped it was formula and not part of some elaborate drug smuggling operation. The problem was I didn't know how much water to add to the mix and ended up reenacting Goldilocks and the Three Bears. The first bottle was too thin, the next bottle so thick Nevaeh couldn't get anything out. I finally aimed for middle ground and shook it into something she could tolerate. The act of drinking apparently filled the baby with an inhuman amount of gas, because she belched like a long-haul trucker. The noise was enough to make her soil herself, and then spit up again. This upset my lady's delicate sensibilities, and she started screaming, full blast. At a loss about where I could even start addressing these issues, I started crying too. Seeing a grown woman cry seemed to have a soothing effect on the baby. She calmed down enough to let me pull off her little pink outfit and open her diaper. I don't want to go into details, but I have a hard time believing that much of such a disgusting material could come out of someone so small. I changed Nevaeh into a clean, little diva onesie and laid her in the bouncy seat long enough to take the diaper out back and bury it. When I came back into the house, she was dozing. I crept quietly up the first stair so I could get to a non-vomity shirt. The baby sensed this and let out a hoarse cry. I rushed back to her, searching the couch cushions for her pacifier. This calmed her down until I tried for the stairs again. In fact, every time I tried to get near clean clothes or left the 10-foot baby perimeter, Nevaeh made her dissatisfaction known. And they say babies aren't aware of their surroundings. This sleeping, crying, holding my clean shirt hostage cycle continued for an hour or so. Then a tentative knock sounded at the front door.
"Thank God you're back,"
I said as I opened it, carefully balancing the baby on my hip. "Don't you ever do this again, Mama Ginger. Do you under..." "Adam?" Adam was standing on my porch, looking tousled and tanned in a blue pullover that brought out the violet undertones in his eyes. He was carrying 2 carry-out cups of coffee.
"Hey, Jane. I thought that since we haven't been able to get together for coffee, I would bring coffee to you."
He smiled broadly, and I felt warm. It was like standing in sunlight, only without the spontaneous combustion. He took one look at my desperate, frazzled state and put the coffee down on the porch.
"Who have you got there?"
he asked in a typical male jabbering at baby's tone. "This is Nevaeh. Ginger Lavelle dropped her off a while ago, and I thought it was her at the door, ready to pick her up. She's got to come back for her soon, right?" I babbled as I checked the clock. Mama Ginger had left 4 hours ago. Where could she be? What if Mama Ginger left her until morning, when I was basically inanimate and unable to hear the cries of a hungry, uncomfortable baby? "Oh, my Lord, what if she doesn't come back?" I cried. "I can't take care of a baby. I'm terrible at this. She's been crying off and on for hours, and no matter what I do, she won't let me put her down long enough to get a clean shirt, and I don't know what to do."
"Oh, it's okay, Jane," he said in a calm, soothing tone, which I assumed was as much for my benefit as the baby's.
He took her from me, and she gurgled and cooed at him as she settled into his arms, obviously preferring him over me after just a few moments. The little traitor.
"Why don't you go upstairs and clean up? I'll look after her for a few minutes."
"Are you sure?" I asked, though I already had one foot on the bottom stair. He nodded, and without further hesitation, I raced up the stairs to degoo myself. Within 10 minutes, Adam had Nevaeh fed, burped, cleaned up, and asleep on his shoulder. Wearing fresh clothes and carrying my soiled shirt at arm's length, I found him bouncing her gently in his arms, with her little head tucked under his chin. The low lights danced over the dark gold of his hair as he swayed Nevaeh back and forth. The sight of Adam with a baby in his arms made my silent heart do a little flip. In my best daydreams, that was what I imagined it would be like to be married and have a family. A good, steady man standing in my house with a sleeping child cradled quietly against him. This was